You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, November 9th. I'm Mike Stupai from Drake University. Here is our first story. Our first story is 9,173 voters weigh in. Shudak, two incumbents win Council Bluffs seat. This story is by Scott Stewart, David Goblitz, and Tim Rower, who write for the Nonpareil. The photo is a woman voting. While the dust is still settling, the lineup for the Council Bluffs City Council is clear. Jill Shudak, an outgoing member of the Council Bluffs School Board, received the most votes in Tuesday's general election, earning a spot on the council with about 24% of the votes. I'm very proud and excited to represent the people of Council Bluffs, Shudak said. A lot of people helped me knock doors, and a lot of people donated to my campaign, 10 cents at a time through the different unions, and I'm just very excited to get to work for the people of Council Bluffs. Shudak will be joined by two incumbents, Roger Sandow and Joe DeSalvo, who finished with about 20% and 19% of the votes, respectively. I feel good, Sandow said on election night. Happy to serve the community for another 4 years. You know, I said it 8 years ago when I got elected, you surround yourself with good people and you'll be successful. DeSalvo told the Nonpareil that he's just happy to be in the top half. Chad Hannon, who has served one term on the council, announced that he wouldn't seek re-election in late August, opening the door for at least one new face at City Hall. Kimberly Kolakowski, Executive Director of Family Incorporated, finished in fourth place with nearly 16% of voters supporting her candidacy. In response to finishing fourth in a three-seat race for the Council Bluffs City Council, Kolakowski said, "The community has spoken and have elected candidates to be the leaders of our city. That's the beauty of elections. People have a voice. I feel I gave it my all and then some, and I had amazing people who supported me." Nevertheless, Kolakowski was curious why voters ultimately re-elected the two incumbents after she heard many frustrated comments during her campaign, including a feeling there's a lot of sameness on the council. "I was interested in bringing a fresh, new perspective," Kolakowski said. "The positive thing from this election is that now we know what to expect. Pat Miller, about 15%, and Christopher Carey, about 5%, also competed for a spot on the council." Our next story is Carter Lake candidate facing lawsuit wins election. Acrimony seems likely at Carter Lake City Hall given Tuesday's election results. Voters chose Jason Gunderson, 431 votes, Jacob Hanukkah, 335 votes, and Aaron Grell, 319 votes, to join the Carter Lake City Council. Grell is being sued by Jackie Carl, an outgoing council member John Patterson and his wife Sharon over a comment made at an October 16th council meeting where Grell accused Patterson and Carl of having an affair. The lawsuit was filed in Pottawatomie County District Court late Friday, and Grell wasn't aware of it until contacted Monday afternoon by the Nonpareil. "That's some funny stuff," Grell said at the time, accurately predicting his election the following day and saying he planned to probe whether Carl is performing required job duties. Carl told the Nonpareil that Grell has repeatedly made false statements about her. "This was kind of the last straw, because he said it in a public meeting," Carl said. Incumbents Ashley Wilson, 229 votes, Kibi Kessler, 188 votes, fell short of re-election, and Jess Driscoll, 151 votes, finished last overall. Our next story is, one vote separates apparent winner, loser, and trainer. One vote can certainly matter, and that reality is on display in Trainer. In a four-way race for three seats, the apparent loser of the contest fell short by a single vote. Robert Wilkie received 256 votes, just shy of Brian Dreyer's 257 votes. If the unofficial results hold, Dreyer will be seated on the board, while Wilkie won't. "We're proud of the campaign we ran," Wilkie said. "To come this close, it's humbling and disappointing at the same time." Wilkie said that he lacked the name recognition the other candidates had. "We felt like we needed to run a more active campaign," he said. "We did all sorts of events, and we got to meet a lot of great people. The fact that he was short just one vote shows the importance of people voting and that every vote matters, he said. Since he has respect for the elected board members, his defeat on Tuesday is a lot easier to accept, Wilkie added. He doesn't plan to request a recount. I'm not going down that path, Wilkie said. Keith Christensen finished second with 286 votes, while Annika Olson was first with 298 votes. With such a close margin, it's worth noting that the results remain unofficial at this point and could change during the canvassing. That is, without a recount, as provisional ballots are considered. Our next story is Lewis Central voters don't retain appointed board member. Lewis Central Community School District voters rejected a $90 million bond proposal while selecting school board members who will now have to go back to the drawing board. Incumbent Amy Atkins won re-election, 1,394 votes, along with Timothy Wright, 1,460 votes, and Alex Sorensen, 1,222 votes. Voters passed up on Travis Houston, who earned 1,150 votes after being appointed to the board late last year to fill a vacancy created by Bob Hendricks moving outside the district. Jeremy Bach came in last with 1,081 votes in a tight five-way race for three seats. Additionally, voters cast 257 write-in votes for a vacancy on the Lewis Central School Board. Those results were still being tallied Wednesday afternoon. The seat became open when Houston decided to seek a full four-year term for another board seat. Whenever a replacement is needed to fill a seat, it comes before a public vote in the next election, Superintendent Brent Housing said. Since nobody took out election papers to be on ballot for that open seat, write-in votes were needed for filling that seat, Housing said, adding that the write-in winner will fill that seat for the next 2 years. Our next story is, some Underwood school voters saw double on ballots. Residents who live in the Underwood Community School District might have thought that they were seeing double when they looked at their ballots on Tuesday. McClelland Mayor Mitch Kay's name was listed twice, once for his unopposed re-election as mayor, and again to be a member of the Underwood School Board. Iowa Code Section 3911 states that elected officials shall not hold more than one elective office at the same level of government. Kay, whose day job is as CFO of Pottawatomie County, said that it's the last phrase, same level of government, that's the key. There's no levying or taxing authority that overlaps to any of that, Kay told the Nonpareil in an interview Wednesday. Kay also pointed to Iowa Code Section 4941, which states, person shall not be a candidate for more than one office to be filled at the same election, except that a person may be a candidate for a city office and school board office at the same election. Kay suggested that perhaps one could be a mayor and also a county supervisor, because one's at the city level of government and the other is county. However, I think that may be too many conflicts, so I don't think anyone would choose to do that. For example, Pottawatomie School Board of Supervisors Chair Brian Shea was a mayor of Crescent when he was first elected to the board, and he stepped down from his position as mayor. Our next story is, incumbent finishes sixth for Council Bluffs School Board. An eight-way race for four seats on the Council Bluffs School Board left an incumbent back in sixth place, alibi a two-vote margin. Incumbent Dave Cozier finished first with 1,613 votes, followed by former interim school board member Teresa Hardiman with 1,612 votes. Angela Greiner finished third with 1,497 votes, and Tracy Azzello also won election with 1,322 votes. Scott Hansen, a former board member seeking a return to the board, fell short with 1,225 votes, followed closely by incumbent board member Troy Arthur with 1,223 votes. Trailing the pack were Amy Foster with 762 votes and Danny Jones with 752 votes. I was sad to lose, but I wasn't entirely surprised, Arthur told the Nonpareil on Wednesday, citing a climate of negativity on school boards here and nationwide. There's a lot of pressure for change, she said. There are forces on both political sides that want to drive change, and school boards are stuck in the middle. We have to wait on both sides and make decisions. School boards are subject to state laws, which constrain how they operate, he said. Sometimes you have to make tough decisions, Arthur said. I think I do that well. It's not an easy job. He said he wishes the best for the new board members, and he expressed pride in the work he did over the past 12 years. He wasn't sure if he might run again for the board. We did a lot of accomplishments over that time, Arthur said. I led a lot of change, a lot of redevelopment, a lot of improvements in education, and great programs that other districts envy. Our next story is, most voters in county choose to sit out general election. A total of 9,173 ballots were cast across Pottawatomie County. The county had 6,916 registered voters as of November 2nd, according to the Iowa Secretary of State's office. Of those, 25,390 were listed as inactive. Additionally, voters can register on Election Day, which could affect the exact number of registered voters in the county. Using the November 2nd registration figures, Tuesday contests saw about a 14% turnout. Using the figure for just active voters, the turnout would still only be 23.81%, less than a quarter. The last post-midterms off-cycle election in 2019 drew a similar turnout, 14.2%, according to the Pottawatomie County Auditor's Office. The day has been pretty average, just a few calls from poll workers with basic questions, Pottawatomie County Auditor Mel Hauser said as polls were closing. Everything seems to have run pretty smoothly. Kolakowski, the unsuccessful candidate for Council Bluffs City Council, said that she felt Council Bluffs city leaders didn't stress the importance of the election enough with the public. That was absent from then, and that was surprising to me, Kolakowski said. For comparison, the August 1st special election over how Pottawatomie County supervisors are elected, which resulted in no change, drew 8,129 ballots, about 88.6% of Tuesday's overall showing. Turnout in the 2022 midterm election was 44.88%, saw 29,170 ballots cast. The 2020 presidential election saw a turnout of 69%, with 45,931 ballots cast. The county reported 899 absentee ballots were cast, or about 9.8% of the total. Four people showed up to the polls Tuesday to cast a blank ballot, according to the unofficial results. Our next story is Underwood shows dissatisfaction, tosses two incumbents. Robert Dose, Underwood's mayor pro term, who serves in the mayor's absence, won't continue representing the community on the Underwood City Council. Dose earned the least support of six candidates competing for three seats on the council, with a showing of 65 votes. Voters also rejected incumbent Royce Furbush, who was appointed to his seat in September of 2020. Furbush finished fourth overall with 111 votes. Newcomers Jody Bowes, 191 votes, and Kel Irwin, 133 votes, will join incumbent Josh Madsen, 146 votes, on serving the council. Keith Rodenberg finished fifth with 99 votes. In a questionnaire, Irwin told the Nonpareil that voters in Underwood have continued to voice concerns about communications and accountability, areas where Irwin said the city could improve. Our local government should be an accessible, transparent, and safe location for the entire community, said Irwin, a small business owner. In the school board contest, Pottawatomie County CFO and McClellan Mayor Mitchell Kay drew the most votes, 513 total, to join the board, which will evaluate how to move forward after a proposed $13.7 million bond was rejected by voters. Kay will be joined by incumbents Matt Brummett, 487 votes, and Teresa Mace, 478 votes. Newcomer Jessica J. finished last with 229 votes and did not win election. Our next story is Tri-Center draws strong support for voter-approved PPEL. Voters in the Tri-Center Community District supported two public measures. A revenue purpose statement received 88.6% of approval, while a voter-approved physical plant and equipment levy earned nearly 79.5% support among Pottawatomie County voters. The PPEL, first authorized at the maximum rate in 2017, allows Tri-Center to invest in its buildings, grounds, sports complexes, and bus fleet. Superintendent Angela Huseman said, PPEL funds can also go to facilities maintenance and technology. The district's revenue purpose statement outlines how it can spend PPEL and sales tax dollars. TriCenter crafted the statement broadly to allow for flexibility within the allowed uses for these revenue sources. Our next story is Pottawatomie County issues moratorium on wind solar permits for up to a year. This story is by David Golbitz, who writes for the Nonpareil. The Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors voted 4-1 on Tuesday to enact a one-year moratorium on issuing permits for any wind or solar energy projects. The moratorium comes as the county is working to amend the county zoning ordinance with updated language about wind energy and the addition of solar energy provisions. It is a fairly common practice, Planning and Development Director Matt Wynett told the board. We are undergoing a major revision of our Chapter 8 ordinances in relation to wind and the addition of solar. We know that we have projects out there currently looking to start up. This would allow us to hold off on issuing permits for those until the Board of Supervisors adopts the new regulations for wind and solar in Pottawatomie County. Further in the article, there is a picture of a windmill. The county has been working with attorneys from Omaha-based law firm Baird Holm since June to modernize the county's existing ordinance. The resolution that was passed Tuesday prohibits the county from approving any wind or solar projects for 365 days, or until the board completes its review and amendment of the ordinance regulating wind and solar energy conversion systems, whichever is earlier. Supervisor Susan Miller, the lone dissenting vote, said that she doesn't think the board needs that much time to review and approve the new regulations. She thinks a tighter time frame would have forced the board to act quicker. "We've got a public hearing scheduled for next week," Miller said. "We're having a town hall out to Oakland on Thursday, so I expect some conversation there. I know we're getting bombarded with information that all needs to be carefully reviewed. I don't think we need to stall out approving a revised ordinance. I think we need to move forward diligently. By having 180 days, it makes it a lot quicker for us, so we've got to turn it quickly." Supervisor Tim Wichman agreed that the board will probably be able to review and approve the amended ordinance sooner than the resolution allows, and that ultimately the number of days written in the resolution doesn't really matter. "The language of the resolution specifically says that once we have completed the review and set the ordinance, that goes away," Wichman said. Wyant said that there are currently three active alternative energy products, two wind and one solar, that are close to requesting permits, so writing and reviewing the amended county ordinances sooner rather than later would be beneficial to all parties involved. "I believe we can get it done a lot faster," Miller said when casting her vote. Our next story is HFS offers problem gambling services. This story is written by Scott Stewart, who writes for the Nonpareil. The photo included is a picture of the Council Bluffs Casino. Heartland Family Service is reminding those struggling with gambling addiction or who know someone is struggling that they can get help. The nonprofit receives grant funding from the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services for prevention specialists to help people learn more about problematic gambling and provide gambling prevention in the workplace, especially during football and basketball seasons. With so many sporting events either in progress or soon to begin, betting on the outcomes of different situations during the game will also take place, HFS said in a news release. The risks of problematic betting increase for student athletes, as well as college students and young adults. "Gambling and sports betting is not a game of skill. It's a game of chance in which the house, app, or bookie's advantage is real. For some people in Iowa, sports betting presents a real challenge. The Iowa Department of Public Health survey data says 27% of Iowa adults know someone whose gambling may be causing a problem, and 22% of Iowans report being negatively affected by other people's gambling. Those who are worried about their gambling or are concerned about a loved one can call Heartland Family Services Problem Gambling Treatment Program in Iowa by calling 402-552-7400. Signs to watch for include restlessness or irritability when trying to reduce or stop playing or betting, preoccupation about placing bets, chasing losses by gambling more in the hopes of getting even, negative impact on relationships, jobs, hobbies, finances, etc., asking others to help cover gambling debts, and stealing to cover gambling losses. Our next story is Page Turner's Book Club Turns 30 by Tim Rohwer, who writes for the Nonpareil. The picture included is a picture of the Page Turner's Book Club. Over the past 3 decades, they've probably turned about 75,000 pages. The Page Turner's Book Club celebrated its 30th anniversary in October, with Council Bluffs women among its members reading about 300 books together, perhaps more. It has lasted because we're all different personalities and have different likes in books, said club member Jen Bass, a former columnist for the Nonpareil. The club, which currently has 9 members, meets once a month to discuss a book previously assigned, she said. They usually meet at a member's home and occasionally at a local village inn restaurant, which has a long provided table for them, Bass said. The meetings start around 9:30 a.m. with the social hour. Sometimes that social hour can keep going and going, Bass said while laughing. Most of the meeting, however, focuses on what the members thought of the assigned book, she said. The meetings usually wrap up around 11:30 a.m. The January meeting is considered the organization's meeting for the year, when each member picks a month to host the event, as well as selecting a book to read for discussion for that date, Bass said. Everyone is involved in selecting the next titles to read, she said. The December gathering is more of a Christmas social lunch at a local restaurant, she said. We don't have officers, said Bass. We just keep track of the books we've read. Bass and fellow Council Bluffs resident Patricia Murphy are the 2 remaining charter members of the club, yet most of the others have been dedicated members for years and years. As one might imagine, they've read all sorts of topics and genres: fiction, nonfiction, autobiographies, books with lighthearted content, and those with sad, serious themes, such as Life During the Holocaust. Among the more famous books read are To Kill a Mockingbird, The Da Vinci Code, The Book Thief, and Killers of the Flower Moon, which has a movie adaptation currently in theaters. We are currently reading The Last Comanche Chief, The Life and Times of Quanah Parker by Bill Neely, Bass said. She herself likes to suggest authors from the South to a lot of members. A lot had harsh upbringings in the South, she said. They seem more realistic. They follow life's hardships. If members don't like reading a book they find unappealing, they're still welcome to attend meetings, she said. The idea of forming a book club developed in the early 1990s after Bass was recuperating from breast cancer and chemotherapy treatment. Depressed, she sought guidance from a counselor, Sharon Ballinger, who suggested getting back into public activities. She suggested that I try to lessen the feelings of depression and live my life anew, Bass said. Since both enjoyed reading, the idea of them forming a book club seemed like a natural fit. Bass selected the name Page Turners from the title of a bookstore. I thought it was a nice name, she said. Bass and Bellinger held their first meeting in October of 1993. I think there are 5 to 6 of us to start with, Bass said. Then it got up to 10 to 12 members within a year. Over the years, the number of active members would get back low, but eventually they grew to 9. That's what we have now, Bass said. The club not only provides social opportunities, but encourages its members to read books they might otherwise ignore. That can obviously expand their knowledge of the world, Bass said. I've had members say that they might not have read those books on their own, and that the books were fantastic. Bass hopes the club continues for many more years. We hope somebody will carry it on when we're gone, she said. Contact Bass at writerjan1212@gmail.com. Of course, Page Turners isn't the only book club in the Council Bluffs and Carter Lake area. The Council Bluffs Public Library hosts several adult book clubs, some focusing on specific types of books. The library's clubs include The Mystery Club, held on the first Tuesday of each month at 7 p.m. Worlds Away Sci-Fi and Fantasy, held on the first Thursday at 7 p.m. Lunch Bunch Fiction and Nonfiction, held on the third Tuesday of each month at noon. Nonfiction, held on the third Wednesday of each month at 7 p.m. Author Chat, where authors discuss their selected work through a virtual platform at various times. The Carter Lake Library offers the Lakers Review Book Club on the first Thursday of each month at 11 a.m. Our next story is Iowa HHS plans Council Bluffs listening session on Medicaid. The Iowa Department of Health and Human Services will host a Council Bluffs listening session next month for Iowans receiving community-based services to share their experiences with Iowa Medicaid leaders. The listening section, part of a series called Hometown Conversions planned all across the state, is scheduled for Thursday, November 16th from 1 to 2:30 p.m. at the YMCA Health and Living Center at 714 South Main Street. Hometown Conversions is part of the Hope and Opportunity in Many Environments initiative to redesign Iowa's Medicaid waiver system, according to a news release. Since the start of the Home Initiative, we've made seeking the input of Iowans a key priority in informing the direction, and we are excited to continue that commitment through our upcoming community conversations, Iowa Medicaid Director Elizabeth Manny said. We are looking to Iowans with experience navigating these services to help us make the right decisions and guide how we move forward. Community-based services allow older Iowans and people with disabilities to receive care in their homes and communities rather than in an institution. The focus of these sessions is to hear from Iowans who use community-based services, caregivers, advocates, service providers, case managers, and other invested parties. The session participants will hear from Medicaid leadership about the goals of the Home Initiative and updates about recent accomplishments and upcoming activities. The Home Initiative began in late 2022 with a collaboration between partners at Mathematica and the Harkin Institute, who evaluated Iowa's community-based services and published an evaluation outlining recommendations for how Iowa can improve services. Using the recommendations in the evaluation, HHS created a transformation plan to guide next steps and implement suggested improvements. Other listening sessions will be held in Burlington, Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, Dubuque, Fort Dodge, Marshalltown, Osceola, Oskaloosa, Sioux City, Spencer, and Waterloo. A virtual session is available Tuesday, November 28th from noon to 1:30 p.m. A Spanish language virtual event is set for Thursday, November 30th from 4 to 5:30 p.m. Additionally, a virtual Medicaid town hall will be held Thursday, December 7th from 4 to 5 p.m. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, November 9th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Mike from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this, or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Our first obituary is Barbara Ann Adams Corrin. She was alive from June 13, 1930, and passed away on November 6, 2023. Barbara Ann Adams Corrin, age 93, of Council Bluffs, formerly of Neola, Iowa, passed away on November 6, 2023, at her home, surrounded by her loving family. Barb was born June 13, 1930, in Neola to the late Thomas N. and Anna B. Adams. She married Freeman R. Corrin on November 30, 1950. Together, they farmed in Neola from 1950 to 2005, raising four children, Richard, Janet, Joyce, and Jane. Barb was an active member of St. Patrick Catholic Church in Neola. In addition to her parents, Barb was preceded in death by her husband of 55 years, Freeman Corrin, in 2005, great-grandson Theodore Walkup, sisters Trudy Russell, Margaret Johnson, and Mary Jo Dressel, brothers Philip and Joseph Adams. Barb is survived by her son, Richard, daughters Janet Ash of Omaha, Joyce Page, Jane Corrin, honorary daughter Stacy Beebe, all of Council Bluffs, three grandchildren, Jasmine Pidak, Amanda Johnson, Becca Walkup, seven great-grandchildren, Taylor and Peyton Pidak, Charlie Carlson, Lucille Walkup, Beckett, Archer, and Sawyer Johnson, brother Tom Adams, many nieces and nephews. Recitation of the Rosary, Tuesday, 5 p.m., followed by visitation with the family until 8 p.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church, Neola. Mass of Christian burial will be on Wednesday at 11 a.m. at the church. Interment at St. Patrick's Cemetery, Neola, with a lunch following in the parish hall. memorial contributions are suggested to St. Patrick Catholic Church, Hillcrest Hospice, or the Alzheimer's Association. Our next obituary is for Kent E. Prewitt. Kent was born January 25, 1959, and passed away on November 3, 2003. Kent E. Prewitt, age 64, of Kimberling City, Missouri, passed away November 3, 2023. Kent was born January 25, 1959, in Council Bluffs to the late Charles and Beverly Ann Prewitt. He graduated from Underwood, Iowa High School in 1977 and graduated from Creighton University in 1981. Kent married Jody Newsome and together raised their family just outside of Council Bluffs in the home he built. He joined the family business, Prewitt Implement, for several years before starting his own business, JK Quality Customs, where he was a contractor, carpenter, and custom cabinet maker. Kent and Jody semi-retired to Table Rock Lake in 2020, where he renovated and remodeled their Dream Forever home. Survived by his wife of 36 years, Jody, and their sons, Benjamin and Bradley, and his first grandchild on the way. Sisters Cindy Everett and Janice Stacy. Visitation with the family will be held on Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service will be Monday at 10 a.m. in the funeral home. Internment will be at Hardin Township Cemetery with a lunch following at the Walnut Hill Reception Center at 1350 East Pierce Street. The family will direct memorials. Our next obituary is for Renita Solentic. Renita was born on August 29, 1939, and passed away on November 7, 2023. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hoy Kilinowski Funeral Home on Friday, November 10, 2023. Funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. at the Hoy Kilinowski Funeral Home on Saturday, November 11, 2023. Interment will be at the Omaha National Cemetery. The family will direct memorials. Renita passed away at age 84 at the Chicago Health Bergen Mercy Hospital on November 7, 2023. She was born to the late Victor and Marveline Doman in Council Bluffs, Iowa. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her husband, Joseph Solentic Sr., son Jeff Solentic. Renita is survived by children Richard Christensen, David Christensen, Valerie Oldham, Lance Solentic, Joseph Solentic, Jr., Janann Baker, sister Renee Fry, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, a host of other family and friends. Our next story is titled, War Accelerates in Gaza. Group of Seven Calls for Impended Aid, Humanitarian Pauses. This story is written by Wafa Sharafa, Jack Jeffrey, and Lee Kaith, who write for the Associated Press. In the Gaza Strip, Palestinians living in the heart of Gaza said Wednesday that they could see and hear Israeli ground forces closing in from multiple directions, accelerating the exodus of thousands of civilians as food and water become scarce and the urban fighting between Israel and Hamas heats up. The Israeli army has not given specifics on troop movements as it presses its ground assault, vowing to crush Hamas after the militant group's deadly October 7th assault inside Israel. But residents said Israeli forces had moved into inner neighborhoods of Gaza City amongst intense bombardment all around the surrounding north. Clashes took place within about a half a mile of the territory's largest hospital, Shifa, which has become a focal point in the war. The Israeli military claims Hamas's main command center is located in and under the hospital complex, and that senior leaders of the group are hiding there, accusing the militants of using the facility as a shield. Hamas and hospital staff deny the claim and say that the military is making a pretext to strike it. For Palestinians in Gaza, the hospital is a symbol for civilian suffering in the war. Like others, it has been overwhelmed by a constant stream of wounded and struggling as electricity and medical supplies run out. Tens of thousands of displaced people have been sheltering in and around the complex. The Group of Seven Wealthy Industrial Nations issued a statement Wednesday condemning Hamas and supporting Israel's right to self-defense. But the group also called for impended delivery of food, water, medicine, and fuel, and for humanitarian pauses in the fighting. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu left open the possibility of small pauses to deliver aid, but has ruled out a broader ceasefire unless nearly 240 hostages taken by Hamas are freed. Benny Gantz, a member of Israel's decision-making war cabinet, acknowledged Israel does not yet have a vision for the Gaza Strip after it destroys Hamas rule, but it will include an Israeli security presence in the territory after the war, echoing Netanyahu's comments. More than 70% of Gaza's population of 2.3 million already left their homes since the war began, but the number fleeing the north has dramatically accelerated. Israel is focusing its operations on the city, which are home to some 650,000 people before the war, and where the military says Hamas has its central command and a labyrinth of tunnels. Our next story is Ivanka Trump takes the stand, says she wasn't involved in documents central to father's case. This story was written by Jennifer Peltz and Michael R. Sisak, who write for the Associated Press. The photo included is Ivanka Trump walking into trial with lots of cameras. Ivanka Trump testified Wednesday that she had no role in her father's personal financial statements, echoing her adult brothers about documents central to the civil fraud trial that could reshape Donald Trump's family business. The former president's elder daughter, who has been in his inner circle in both business and politics, rounds out a major stretch in the trial. Her father took the stand on Monday, and her brothers Eric Trump and Donald Trump Jr. testified last week. Unlike her father and brothers, Ivanka Trump is no longer a defendant in New York Attorney General Letitia James' lawsuit. It alleges that Donald Trump's asset values were fraudulently exaggerated for years on annual statements of financial condition that helped him get loans and insurance. "I wasn't involved in his statement of financial condition," Ivanka Trump, a former executive vice president at the family's Trump Organization, told the court during even-tempered testimony that provided a counterpoint to her father's cautistic turn on the stand. Before leaving the company to go with her father to the White House, Ivanka Trump was the point person in establishing a lending relationship with Dutch Bank's private wealth management arm. It eventually extended the company hundreds of millions of dollars in loans, with terms that required Donald Trump to submit his financial statements each year. Ivanka Trump testified that her husband, Jared Kushner, introduced her to a banker as the Trumps sought financing to buy and overhaul the Doral Golf Resort near Miami. The non-jury trial will decide allegations of conspiracy, insurance fraud, and falsifying business records, but Judge Arthur Engoron has already resolved the lawsuit's top claim by ruling that Trump engaged in fraud. That decision came with provisions that could strip the ex-president of oversight, such as marquee properties as Trump Tower, though appeals in court are allowing him to continue control of his holdings for now. James, a Democrat, is seeking over $300 million in penalties and a ban on Trump doing business in New York. The ex-president and Republican 2024 frontrunner denies any wrongdoing, as do the other defendants. Our next story is morale down after Disney takeover. This story was written by Mike Schneider, who writes for the Associated Press. The picture associated with this is a picture of three people testifying. Orlando, Florida. Morale and trust within the Walt Disney government deteriorated since allies of Florida government Ron DeSantis took it over earlier this year, according to many employees who have departed in the recent months, saying the governing district has been politicized and cryonism now permeates the organization. More than 40 out of about 370 employees have left the Central Florida Tourism Oversight District since it was taken over in February, raising concerns that decades of institutional knowledge is departing with them, along with a reputation for a well-run government. "When I first joined the district, I found an organization that strived to be the very best at serving our community, sought the very best employees, and valued those employees above all else," a former facilities manager with 3 years of experience said in an employee exit survey last week. "I find myself leaving a completely different district, a district that prioritizes politics above all else and will gladly sacrifice its employees, its community, and its work if there's an opportunity to score political points. The Associated Press obtained the employee exit surveys through a records request and has withheld names to protect security. Most of the records were first obtained by Seeking Rents, a Florida-based watchdog newsletter. With the departure of so many district employees in such a short period of time, the district is no longer functional, a facilities director who left last month wrote in her exit survey. The Republican governor and GOP-dominated Florida legislature took control of the district in retaliation after Disney publicly exposed a state law banning classroom lessons on sexual orientation and gender identity in early grades. The law was championed by DeSantis, who is currently running for the 2024 GOP presidential nomination. Before the takeover, the governing district had been controlled by Disney supporters. It previously was named the Reedy Creek Improvement District when it was established in 1967 to provide municipal services like road repairs, waste collection, and firefighting on the 25,000 acres that make up Disney's theme park resort in Central Florida. An environmental biologist who departed the district in September after 35 years said the DeSantis allies on the board had negatively changed my experience with top leadership, the work culture, trust, and had given me a good reason to retire. An accountant who also departed in September said she didn't want to leave, but the workplace culture had been destroyed. You now see fake smiles, and I'm sure that a lot of employees are somewhat scared to say what they actually feel because of retaliation, said the former employee who worked in the finance department for 3 years. When asked about the staff departures, a district spokesman said several of the workers who had left had been planning to retire before the change, and that there were still employees with decades of experience who could maintain the institutional knowledge of the district. We are committed to enhancing the well-being of our staff members, said Matthew Oberle, the district's director of external affairs. Our unwavering commitment is to maintain our tradition of excellence and continue delivering outstanding services to our taxpayers. Chairman Martin Garcia has reportedly said in board meetings that the goal of the new leadership is to reform the sweetheart relationship between Disney and the governing district to make the government more accountable and transparent. For over 56 years, Disney had their own governmentally controlled kingdom, Garcia said in August. In the past 6 months, our board has adopted new policies and practices to fix some of the glaring issues. The new board members, though, have been accusing the previous administration of cronyism while at the same time hiring politically connected associates to positions in the district or awarding them contracts, the former facilities manager said in his exit interview last week. One of the five original DeSantis-appointed board members to the Central Florida Tourism Oversight District was the best man at the June wedding of Glenn Gilson, who was named by the new board to be the district's new administrator in May and is a DeSantis ally. Gilson also recently promoted his chief of staff, who he had worked with in his previous job, to be a deputy district administrator. Last month, the district authorized $242,000 with no-bid contract to update its emergency calls network with a company whose chief executive has served with Gilson on the Florida Commission of Ethics, where both were DeSantis appointees. Following pushback from local media reports about the no-bid nature of the deal, the company CEO requested that the contract be reopened for an open bidding process. Disney has sued DeSantis and the members of Central Florida Tourism Oversight District Board in federal court in Tallahassee over the takeover, claiming its free speech rights were violated. Disney is also battling the Central Florida Tourism Oversight District in state court in Orlando. Our next story is, against the odds, Titans ready for semis with North Polk. State semifinal football. This story was written by Austin Heenan, who wrote for the Nonpareil. The picture is a coach and his team celebrating on the sidelines. Not many folks around the state imagined Lewis Central to be among the final four Class 4A teams playing, but after last Friday's 32-21 win over ADM, the Titans have done it again. For the third consecutive year and fifth in 6 years, Lewis Central will play in the Class 4A state semifinal game and take on the North Polk Comets. The Titans started the season as Class 4A's number one team, but plenty of questions surrounded this team as they entered the season with a lot of new names and faces. After playing one of the most challenging schedules in the state, the Titans have proved a lot, but feel there's still more to prove in the semifinals. When you look at our non-district schedule alone, two of those four teams are still playing now, Titans coach Justin Camrad said. A third one of those games happens to be one that we beat to get here, and the other, of course, being Harlan, who is another playoff team. That was some very good competition and really good football teams, and those kind of games help set you up for opportunities like this and help you better understand the situation and just help you measure what it's going to take to be successful. District play also really helped and allowed us to focus in on what we were doing well and what we needed to fix to help with our playoff run. But the majority of the credit goes to these kids and coaches who didn't stop believing we could do this. They all trusted the process, themselves, and each other, and that we could reach this point. But now it's not about getting here anymore. It's about winning a football game. I'm extremely proud of what they've accomplished thus far. From day one, the team knew the challenge ahead of them. Losing playmakers at almost every skill position and lineman, the Titans knew the task at hand. Through the front half of the season, they gave up some tough lessons. The Titans have proven their growth as they ride a 7-game win streak into the semifinal battle, and those lessons are what have prepared them in past years for these kinds of games. Starting the year at 2-2, there was a lot of learning at first, Brad Hetzel said. After those first four games, we really came together and started playing more as a team. Everyone here has each other's back, and that's how teams grow. Right now, it feels amazing after putting in all that work to get here again, Owen Thomas said. We always have high expectations for ourselves and aim for this. We're a very battle-tested team, and that's why I feel like we have a very good chance of winning this again, like we did a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago, we were 2-2, and then made our run to a title. And like that year, I think this team has learned from its mistakes, and the games that we lost, none of us want to feel that again. We have played some of the toughest teams in the state, Camden Cross said. We just played them once again in the quarterfinal, and now we're meeting another one in the semis. Playing these tough, challenging games makes us bond together, especially when we take those losses. We all hate the feeling of losing, and we all come together because none of us want to feel it again. We're ready each week to go out, win the game, and this week push for a shot to play at the state title. The Titans face a North Polk team that has faced some familiar foes to the Titans, such as ADM, Bondurant Farrer, and defeated both squads. The Comets defeated Cedar Rapids Xavier 17-14 to punch their ticket to Cedar Falls. Like the Titans, the Comets present multiple ways to produce offensive success, with a 1,100-yard rusher in B.J. Tate and a committee of receivers such as Cale Yoakum, Brock Miller, Colton Manock, and Charlie Bunkers, who are all around 300 yards in receiving each and combined for 14 receiving touchdowns. Quarterback Isaac Zosky has a multitude of weapons at his disposal. We just have to do our thing, Thomas said. We've added some new things to our playbook to limit their offense, but we might just have to stay true to our coaches and the game plan and make sure that we're doing what we've been coached to do. Just try not to do too much, but not too little either. Just continue what we've been doing and stop the big plays. We have to stop their run game first and make them pass more, Cross said. From what we see on film, they don't want to pass the ball too much compared to keeping it on the ground. So I think if we stop that or contain it well enough, we're going to increase our chances of winning. Defensively, the Comets have one of the best defenses in the state, forcing about 3 turnovers per game and surrendering an average of just 12 points per game, and have only allowed fellow 4A semifinalist Bondurant Farrer to score more points than 21 in a single contest. Helping lead the charge is linebacker Braden Foster, as he leads the Comets with 91 tackles and 20.5 tackles for loss. Nathan Feldman at safety has been a strong force as well, with 61.5 tackles, second on the team, and co-leads the team in forcing 4 turnovers. The Comets defense has faced some powerful offenses earlier, thus the Titans expect a stingy performance on Thursday. First and foremost, it's going to come down to our execution, Cameron said. We have to find some mismatches, but they're really good at defending the pass and run. Some of the big plays we've had in the past may not be here, but we need to stay patient enough to put drives together and possess the ball and move the ball down the field, and that's the biggest thing for us, is finding where we can create opportunities. Their defense is really good, but not a whole lot changes with us, Hetzel said. We really have to focus on not turning over the ball. Executing the little things is going to be huge this week if we want to play for another week after this. The Titans and Comets kick off their game on Thursday at the UNI Dome in Cedar Falls at 4 p.m. Our next story is Area Athletes Sign to Continue Athletic Careers. This story is written by Austin Heinen, who writes for the Nonpareil. The photo included is a picture of local athletes. Multiple area athletes in various sports have signed letters of intent to continue their athletic and academic careers at the college level on Wednesday. Underwood's Elizabeth Jacobson signed to play volleyball at Nebraska Omaha. Trainer had two students sign to continue their volleyball careers as Ella Terks signed to play at Nebraska Omaha and Avery Carallo signed to play for Peru State. Lewis Central's Anna Strohmeyer also signed to continue her volleyball career at Missouri Western State. Lewis Central also had Sydney Collins sign a letter to continue her swimming career at Youngstown State, and Braden Shepard signed to play soccer at Drake University. The Abraham Lincoln Lynx had 10 athletes signed to play sports at the next level. Molly Romano signed to play volleyball at Wayne State College. Allison Smith and Liberty Bates signed to continue their soccer careers, as Bates will be heading to Northern Iowa and Smith had signed to Wartburg College. AL's Olivia Williams and Ava Watkins signed their letters to Wayne State to continue their track and field careers. Mason Garians signed to play baseball at DeWayne College. Caden Dorr signed his letter to play tennis at Morningside. Also for the Lynx, Aiden Martin signed to play baseball at Ellsworth Community College, and Zach Lincoln signed to play baseball at Ellsworth as well. The Nonpareil congratulates all athletes for these accomplishments. Our next story is Titan State Swimmers Prepare Themselves for the State Meet. This was written by Holly Collins, who writes for the Nonpareil. The photo attached is a picture of all the state swimmers. Imagine a life where you get up before the sun to train. You pack food for school because school lunch just isn't enough calories. Drive 30 to 45 minutes one way after school to practice for 2 hours. Get back home with just enough time to do your homework and go to bed. Your weekends are taken up by swim meets. On the day of your homecoming dance, you had to race home from an out-of-town swim meet with your head hanging out the window so your hair could dry. Your dress fits funny because you're shaped like an upside-down triangle. You have accepted that you will have permanent goggle marks on your eyes and always smell like chlorine. You've sacrificed a lot of time with your friends, football games, haunted houses, and all the other fun fall activities. As the Lewis Central girls reflect on their season, they would say it was all worth it. Six girls from LC have advanced to the state swim meet this weekend. Seniors Sydney Collins, Emma Gordon, and Mia Hansen. Freshmen Madeline Kinspell, sophomore Lexi Sturkavius, and Kennedy Zenner are preparing their bodies and minds to swim fast and be fierce this weekend in Marshalltown. Collins, LC, is a four-time state qualifier in relays, a three-time qualifier in the 100 backstroke, two-time qualifier in the 200 individual medley, and this is her first year competing in the 100 breaststroke. Her freshman year, she placed 23rd in the 100 backstroke. Sophomore year, she climbed to 14th. Last year, she placed 14th in the 200 meter race in school record time and 9th in the 100 backstroke, All-State honorable mention. This year, she is ranked 9th in the 200 meter race and 16th in the 100 breaststroke going into the weekend. Right now, I'm focusing a lot on rest and hydration, consuming a surplus of calories with the right nutrition, practicing technique movements I need to make, and devoting time to a positive mindset. Collins described her preparation for this weekend. Hansen, Missouri Valley, is a four-time state qualifier in relays and a first-time qualifier, in the 100 butterfly after a narrow miss last year. She's ranked 29th this weekend. Hansen is preparing by focusing on all the small things and visualizing what I need to do. She went on to clarify, I know all the hard work is done. Now it's time to execute and complete. Gordon, Riverside, is a 3-time state qualifier in relays. The 200 free relay is ranked 21st. With only one race this weekend, I'm working on my starts, turns, and going as fast as possible for my teammates, Gordon explained. This will be the first appearance at state for all the lower classmen. Strakavius Glenwood qualified in a relay and is ranked 30th in the 100 backstroke. I am keeping a positive mindset, getting my body well rested, and working on the little things to fully prepare myself, she detailed. Freshmen Kinspel and Zenner are swimming in relays. Zenner is swimming in all three, and Kinspel is swimming in two relays. The medley relay is ranked 21st, and the 400 free relay is ranked 16th. I'm working on my underwaters, starts, and turns, getting mentally ready and getting plenty of sleep, Kinspel said. Zenner is preparing by making sure my starts and turns are perfect to ensure I can perform my absolute best. In addition to eating and sleeping well, Zenner informed us that she is getting hyped. Coach Bruce Schomburg has a tried and true training method that he does not intend to change now, especially after a 100% team time improvement at regionals. We will get more specific with strokes they are doing. My backstrokers and breaststrokers will do more underwater swimming. We will work on relay starts and turns. A little bit of training, but not much, he explained. I'm hoping we go a little faster and move up a couple of spots, Schomburg specified. Career or season best times, and maybe get some people in the finals, he went on to say. I expect they will hold their own. Swimming starts Friday at 11 a.m. for preliminary individual events. The top 16 will advance to finals on Saturday, starting at noon, where all the relays will compete as well. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, November 9th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. I'm Mike from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.